proposals for President Biden's new COVID-19 vaccine mandate are out, and they've already been put on hold. Under the requirements, companies with at least 100 employees would have to make sure those workers are either vaccinated or undergo weekly testing. Those who are unvaccinated would also have to wear a mask at work. That move would apply to about 84 million people. Workers will be allowed to seek medical and religious exemptions. The changes are set to take effect on January 4th. In a statement on Thursday, President Biden said, quote, "While I would have much preferred that requirements not become necessary, too many people remain unvaccinated for us to get out of this pandemic for good." But on Saturday, a federal appeals panel temporarily blocked that measure, saying, quote, "The petitions give cause to believe there are grave statutory and constitutional issues with the mandate. The injunction has no immediate effect." You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about these new requirements? If you're vaccinated, would they make you feel safer around the office? If you're unvaccinated, would this give you motivation to get the shot? Would you consider leaving your job over that mandate? If you're an employer, what are you wondering about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Brian Dean Abramson is an adjunct professor of vaccine law at the Florida International University College of Law. He's the author of Vaccine, Vaccination, and Immunization Law. Brian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we step into the federal mandate, I wanted to ask you about a big story here in Wisconsin. Aaron Rodgers, Green Bay quarterback, out with COVID, didn't play yesterday in the Packers' loss. He said in an interview Friday he didn't get vaccinated, said he was allergic to something in two of the shots, worried about side effects of another, got an alternative treatment. The NFL considers him unvaccinated. Here's what Rodgers had to say about whether he had lied about his vaccination status.
The organization knew exactly what my status was. My teammates knew exactly what my status was. There was nothing that was hidden.
As someone who studies vaccine law and policy, what are your thoughts on this big sports story here in the state?
Well, it's fascinating. You know, we don't really know what the interchange between Rodgers and the team was, the team management was, with regard to his vaccination status. So taking him at his word, that would mean that the organization allowed him to carry on as if he were vaccinated, even though he didn't receive a vaccine that is approved by the FDA or the CDC. It doesn't meet those standards. You know, there are a lot of kind of treatments out there that are being pushed by charlatans that say that, you know, this will provide you with immunity, that don't do that. So, you know, really the team dropped the ball if that is the exchange that happened, and then they allowed him to carry on as if he was vaccinated. And, you know, if it turns out that his representation of the team was different from what he's saying now, that is in employment law, of course, basis for terminating employees if they misrepresent their vaccination status. But really, I think, you know, people who have an objection to vaccination should just come out and say, well, I have this objection to vaccination, and not engage in sort of machinations where they say that, well, I have some other protection, or where they misrepresent or obfuscate what their actual vaccination status is.
So most of us don't work for the NFL, but a lot of us work with organizations that these new guidelines would apply to under the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA. What stands out most to you about how this vaccination mandate would go into effect on January 4th? What struck you about the rules?
The most remarkable thing about it is how aggressive it is in pressing vaccination as a means to get out of the pandemic. You know, I had thought that there was a chance that OSHA might frame this as a testing requirement, say everyone has to be tested for COVID with vaccination as a way to get out of the testing requirement. And they did not. They went the opposite direction. They said, we want everyone to be vaccinated. This is a vaccination requirement. Companies have to carry out vaccination of their employees. And as a secondary and kind of less preferred alternative, you can have a testing requirement for employees. At the same time, there were some concerns that I had about constitutionality of the regulation, the way that it was initially framed. They did, in their final rule, exempt people who work entirely from home and also exempt people who work entirely outdoors. And that alleviates a lot of concerns that I would have had about, you know, how can the government require people who are entirely teleworking require those people to be vaccinated or require companies to have those employees vaccinated. So in some ways it is more stringent than I had expected, and in some ways it is somewhat lenient, and I did expect that there would be more leniency than what the Biden administration had initially announced.
One of the arguments I've seen against it, as people are companies and conservative legal groups are filing lawsuits against it, the idea that this is OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Administration, not a public health organization. The argument is they don't have the power to fight a pandemic. The Biden administration saying, well, it's a workplace safety issue, so yeah, they do. How do you judge between those two arguments?
Well, there are a couple of things that stick out to me. First of all, that the actual statute that was enacted in 1970 or the early 1970s that creates OSHA specifically says that it is in place to help prevent workplace injuries or illness. So from the very beginning, it has had this remit to combat illness and disease that is spread in the workplace. It's just that the primary activity that OSHA has engaged in over the years is things like making sure people are wearing safety helmets and that people working in high places have harnesses and railings and electrical wires are grounded and things that are much more injury directed. However, in 1991, OSHA did institute a bloodborne pathogen standard, which is directly aimed at preventing the spread of HIV and hepatitis B, and has as a component of that a requirement that employers make the hepatitis B vaccine available to employees, and at least encourages employees to receive that vaccine and requires them to acknowledge, if they don't, that they're at risk of the disease and at risk of spreading the disease and that they have the right to receive it. So it's something that has been in OSHA's remit for the entirety of its existence. It's just not an area that OSHA has directed its resources and attentions to a great deal as compared to workplace injuries that are caused by slips and falls or burns or chemical explosions or things like that.
We're talking about the federal vaccine mandate scheduled to go into effect January 4th. A lot of court challenges between now and then. Brian Dean Abramson is with us from the Florida International University College of Law, author of Vaccine, Vaccination, and Immunization Law. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. John starts us off in Madison. John, hi.
Hi, thanks. I got two questions actually now. One quick one is, are vaccines and their boosters supposed to be free for the foreseeable future to the user? I feel like that's important if they're required. But my more important question is, what would constitute a religious exemption? I know that there are some more wild political movements out there that are starting to sound more like a religion rather than a political movement, and I'm wondering if, like, QAnon would count as a religion.
John, thanks for the call. So to John's first point, is it important that these vaccines are free to allow this this mandate to go forward?
Yes, the vaccines are free. They're expected to remain free for the foreseeable future. That is covered in federal legislation that was passed at the beginning of the pandemic, actually, before the vaccines were developed. And they should remain so. And even if that ceases, if that resides in terms of the vaccines being free, employers would be required to cover the cost of employees receiving the vaccines, as they are for the hepatitis B vaccine for employees in the medical field. But generally speaking, vaccines are a fairly low-cost product per dose. And that goes for, you know, the childhood vaccines. It goes for the flu shot when you go to Walmart or CVS or what have you, and they give you the shot for free and even in some places give you a coupon for going there to get the shot because they're getting paid by Medicare for it. So, you know, someone pays for the cost of it, but so far it's been the United States government that has paid for a tremendous number of doses that should be enough to last years and years. So it'll be a long time before we worry about the cost.
And John asked about what constitutes a religious exemption. What does it take for someone to claim that to avoid the vaccine mandate?
Well, that is a very interesting question because it is somewhat amorphous. The OSHA standard says to look at what the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, has said about religious exemptions. And the EEOC has said to be fairly open-minded towards employers in accepting claims of need for a religious exemption from an employee. The real question that an employer has to assess is this a sincerely held religious belief? And is the belief that is being expressed really religious as opposed to kind of a philosophical or something that's outside the scope of religion? There is historically case law, for example, where someone said that an angel had appeared to them and told them that they shouldn't be vaccinated. And that was ultimately litigated. And the court said, well, you know, they sincerely believe this, so you have to treat it as a sincerely held belief. On the other side, there's an old Delaware case where a woman said that she had pagan beliefs and was against vaccination. But when she was questioned about that, she basically said, I think vaccines are harmful and so forth. And the court said, well, we don't believe that you're sincerely expressing your religious belief. And then this woman said, well, then I'm going to convert and become a Jehovah's Witness, because Jehovah's Witnesses have a longstanding objection to vaccination or belief against vaccination. And the court found that to be insincere, that she wasn't really sincerely becoming a member of that religion. We have seen in recent months, in particular, as vaccine mandates have ramped up, the expansion on the internet of these sort of fly-by-night online ministries that pop up and say, well, for a fee, we will write out a form that says that vaccination is against your religion, and you can provide that to your employer. And I really think that that's unfortunate. I think that it harms the status of religion in our society as a force that has been part of the fabric of this country since its founding. You know, we don't want religion to come to be seen as just this means to an end through which someone can avoid getting out of something they don't want to do.
We're talking about the Biden administration's new COVID-19 vaccination mandate set to take effect early next year. Brian Dean Abramson is with us, adjunct professor of vaccine law at the Florida International University College of Law. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, hear from more of you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the Biden administration's COVID-19 vaccine mandate. Rules just came out, scheduled to go into effect on January 4th, affecting workplaces with at least 100 employees. Lots of court action expected between now and then. Brian Dean Abramson stays with us from the Florida International University College of Law, author of Vaccine, Vaccination, and Immunization Law. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Reggie is with us from Oshkosh on the road right now, I understand. Reggie, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Reggie?
So I work for one of the largest LTL companies in the country, and I have a feeling once this happens, a lot of people are going to leave. I'm vaccinated, but I'm wondering, is there another fallout that's going to come to the trucking industry because of this?
Thanks for the call, Reggie. And I know that's been a concern, Brian, not just in trucking, but in a lot of lines of work. Employers worried, are we going to lose workers, that small percentage who declines to get the vaccine? How big a concern is that?
Well, it is a concern. The OSHA in its rulemaking has considered that, and they've laid out their expectations for how many people they think would leave the workforce and how many would remain. Their expectations, I think, are a bit optimistic, but at the same time, we've seen circumstances where there have been assertions that a large proportion of people are going to leave a particular police force or a particular healthcare organization because of a vaccination mandate that was imposed, and at the end of the day, they ended up having 2 or 3% attrition based on that, or 2 or 3% of employees terminated who refused to be vaccinated. So it is a fairly small portion, but 2 or 3% can still be enough to feel a bit of a bite from it. That's part of the reason I think that the OSHA mandate does have this exception where you can choose to be tested on a weekly basis rather than being vaccinated. I would say with truck drivers in particular, the requirement does, again, exempt people who work outdoors. I think that, you know, there's a degree to which it could be argued that someone who is engaged in truck driving and is not necessarily physically interacting with other people in the course of that job, if there are ways that can be avoided, would be exempt from the mandate requirement. That's something that I think will have to be brought up to OSHA, and, you know, they'll have to determine that when the case arises, when someone says, well, because this is what I do, I'm someone who works outdoors under the meaning of the rule as it has been promulgated. So that's something that will definitely remain to be seen. There also may be some kind of interchange where we see people who work for these larger companies that are under the OSHA requirement leave to work for smaller companies that don't have that mandate imposed upon them. And at the same time, we see some people working for these smaller companies then sort of taking advantage of these openings in the larger companies and saying, well, now that there are jobs available in these large companies, I'm going to go work over there because I am vaccinated or I don't mind this vaccination mandate. So there will be a degree of that happening. But, you know, primarily that's one of the things that OSHA has to examine. They have to examine the economic feasibility of the rule that they promulgate, and they made the determination that it's not going to be a significant factor. And, you know, that's something that we'll have to kind of wait and see how much of a factor it turns out to be. But it hasn't been as substantial a factor as people have been concerned about in a lot of other systems.
Thanks for that call, Reggie. Liz joins us next in Eau Claire. Liz, hi.
Hi there.
What do you want to bring up, Liz?
Hi. Well, I have, first of all, I want to say I do support President Biden's mandate for large employers to require vaccination. That's happening at some places here in Eau Claire. But also, my question is, I recently canceled an appointment at a clinic, a small clinic, because they did not require employees to be vaccinated. And one of the employees told me that this would be a HIPAA violation to require employees to be vaccinated. And I'm confused by that. Is that true?
Liz, thanks for the call. A lot of misinformation about HIPAA, this Health Insurance Portability Act law. Brian, can you tackle Liz's question?
Yes. HIPAA is very specifically directed at healthcare providers. So a healthcare provider cannot release your medical information without your permission. That does not prevent, and it has been held in various proceedings, it doesn't prevent an employer from asking about someone's vaccination status or their COVID status. It doesn't prevent it doesn't prevent an employer from requiring that the employee have the healthcare provider provide that information to the employer. So there's no HIPAA violation incumbent in the vaccination mandate, or really in any vaccination mandate. And generally speaking, as a society, we have had vaccination and vaccination mandates for hundreds of years, and have enacted legislative protocols such as HIPAA with the understanding that vaccination is part of what we do as Americans, and that information needs to be conveyed to those who need to know, particularly in the school systems, of course, where students need to be vaccinated and their vaccination status has to be conveyed. But also for a very long time, there have been vaccination requirements in the private sector. There used to be ubiquitous smallpox vaccination requirements back when smallpox was endemic in the population. And that information had to be conveyed to employers. And more recently, there have been flu vaccination requirements and a host of other requirements in the healthcare field specifically. So that isn't really a concern. There is a requirement under the Americans with Disabilities Act that employers not inquire about a particular disability. So if someone says that they are unable to be vaccinated due to a medical reason, the employer can't pry too deeply into what is the medical basis for their being unable to be vaccinated. But that's really the only privacy-based limitation on an employer's ability to ask that information. And, of course, an employer that has that information has to be very careful with it, as you have to be with all private information that you hold about your employees.
Liz, thanks for that call. We're going out to Terry in Milwaukee. Terry, hi.
Yeah, good afternoon. I wanted to just correct the misunderstanding that your guest has. Earlier in the discussion, he mentioned that for many years, Jehovah's Witnesses have been against vaccines or vaccinations. That is totally untrue. I've been one of Jehovah's Witnesses for 45 years, served on the Hospital Liaison Committee, the chairman of the Hospital Liaison Committee for Southeastern Wisconsin, and 99% of all of our branch members in New York, 5,000 in the branch offices in New York, 99% of all of the branch members have been fully vaccinated. if you watch our latest broadcast on JW.org, they mention how many have been vaccinated at the branch offices and sharing facts, medical facts, and scientific facts about the efficacy of these vaccines.
Terry, thanks for the call. We don't have much time left. A producer pulled up. It looks like that stance changed in 1952, where Jehovah's Witnesses said, nope, vaccines are your choice. Quick thoughts on that, Brian. Does that make it less likely that somebody will claim religious exemptions?
Well, actually, I do want to thank the caller for raising that point. There was historically a period where Jehovah's Witnesses were opposed to vaccination. That was the doctrine of the organization. And that did change. That has changed. There are still people, as in that case in Delaware, evidence who believe that becoming a Jehovah's Witness means being able to claim such an exemption. And there are religious doctrines, there are religions where vaccination and medical treatment in general is kind of frowned upon as showing a lack of faith in God healing you from things through prayer or things of that sort. But there are very, very few that have expressed any kind of specific and isolated objection to vaccination as opposed to medicine in general. And that's kind of a suspicious thing when a religious organization says, you know, well, we're going to accept, for example, testing on aborted fetal cells for every other medication, but we're going to object to vaccines because they go through that testing process as well.
Terry, thanks a lot for clearing that up with us. I appreciate that. And Brian, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Brian Dean Abramson, adjunct professor of vaccine law at the Florida International University College of Law, also author of Vaccine, Vaccination, and Immunization Law. We talked to him today about the Biden administration's new COVID-19 requirements. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, Milwaukee just achieved unique status for its recreation department. Find out what a national recognition means for Wisconsin's biggest city. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. This year marks the program's 10th anniversary here on WPR. As part of the celebration, we're sharing some of our favorite stories. Here's producer Steve Gotcher with a story about musician Joni Mitchell's time in Madison.
This story brings together a midwinter ice storm, the southeast shore of Lake Mendota in Madison, ice skating, and a series of photographs that became a record album cover. Dean Robbins takes us back in time to a cold February photo session on the bleak frozen lake.
I remember the 1970s as a time of journeys. College kids like me were forever on the road to discovery, whether hitchhiking or exploring our inner selves. That's why we idolized Joni Mitchell.
I'm traveling in some vehicle. I'm sitting in some cafe.
Like us, this eccentric singer-songwriter was on a quest. We followed her progress from the open-hearted folky of Chelsea Morning to the jaded romantic of Blue to the brash pop star of Help Me. In 1976, Mitchell's wanderlust brought her to Madison in a spontaneous photo shoot on Lake Mendota. Months later, the photographs appeared on an album jacket, encapsulating both Joni's career and the self-analytical post-hippie era she ruled over. Mitchell came to Madison for a February concert at the Dane County Coliseum in the midst of an ice storm. She'd just broken up with her longtime boyfriend and called off the rest of her troubled tour, so her emotional state was melancholy in the extreme. Gazing at frozen Lake Mendota from the Edgewater Hotel, she felt the call of the glassy white void. She could hear tree branches cracking under the weight of the ice, a sound reminiscent of tinkling glass. Mitchell went into town to buy a pair of skates, choosing men's black to match her mournfulness. She donned a long black skirt and a black ermine cape and leaped onto the ice. The surface was dangerously spongy. Freezing cold water splashed onto Joni's face, leaving welts. But she felt compelled to go through with her mad plan. Her photographer followed along to record the strange scene. Mitchell was surprised to find that her cape acted as a sort of sail. She spread her arms and let the wind carry her, looking like a crow in flight. The photographs captured a mystical moment, an artist on an unearthly journey, destination unknown, and arrival uncertain. Joni liked the photos so much that she used them for black and white montages on her album Hajira. The title is an Arabic word meaning journey, and the wintry images fit perfectly with the musical message. Chilled by jazz rock guitar, the songs are less melodies than moods. They're less pop than poetry. In Coyote, Amelia, and other meandering masterpieces, Mitchell evokes the restlessness of the road, mirroring the restlessness of her soul. Jaco Pastorius's prodding bass seems like a stand-in for the psychic obsession she can't let go of. Rolling Stone picked Hajira's cover as one of the best ever, but for a Madison resident, it has special meaning. It shows us that frozen Lake Mendota is not just a place for casual recreational activities. It can also be something far more mysterious, an expanse of endless possibility.
You still have your music, and I've still got my eyes on the land and the sky. You sing for your friends and your family. I'll walk green pastures by and by.
Dean Robbins is a journalist and author based in Madison. He's won state and national awards for arts, features, and news stories, and has contributed to magazines and newspapers around the country. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television, in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Now, Milwaukee Recreation is getting some national recognition. The division of Milwaukee Public Schools that oversees community programs and education centers in the district was recognized by the Commission for Accreditation of Park and Recreation Agencies with a nationwide accreditation. Only 2% of parks and rec departments around the country have received that recognition. Milwaukee is just the third here in the state of Wisconsin. Lynn Greb is director of Milwaukee Recreation. I talked to her earlier today about the impact of this accomplishment. Lynn, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. I'm so happy to be here.
Can you tell us what this accreditation means for you at Milwaukee Recreation and the people you serve?
Well, we're super excited to have been given the designation of the CAPRA accreditation. And for us, it really means that, to me, it validates the work we do for the Milwaukee community. It held us up against 154 standards. We actually met 100% of the standards with the review. And I believe that really solidifies our place as the leading provider of quality recreation for Milwaukee.
Can you give us a sense of the scope of the different facilities and programs you operate there at Milwaukee Recreation?
Well, we like to say that we program in more than 100 locations on an annual basis, but what's unique about our operation is that most of our indoor programming occurs within the Milwaukee Public School facilities. And then we also manage 52 play fields that service our outdoor activities, our playgrounds, our softball leagues, all the basketball, all the things that people like to do outside. And then we have a couple special sites. We actually operate a farm out in Dousman, Wisconsin, Oak Ridge Farm, and that's a partnership we have with the DNR. And we also have a nature center right here in the city of Milwaukee, Hawthorne Glen, which is a beautiful gem located right, like I say, in the heart of Milwaukee.
As I understand it, Milwaukee Rec is the only school district-run agency to get this accreditation. How can you talk about the relationship with the district in running all those programs you just mentioned?
It's really unique to the state of Wisconsin. Back in the early 1900s, the state legislature passed a law that allowed school districts to levy tax dollars for community recreation services. And so a number of schools, districts in the state of Wisconsin have operated this way, and they have their own recreation department that provides programs for their entire community, which is how we're set up in Milwaukee. And I really think that that relationship is not only unique, but very beneficial, especially to the taxpayer, because we make use of existing facilities. We don't have to put all our money into capital and infrastructure. And that way we can pour more of our resources into the actual programming. And that really, I think, what is what sets us apart as a department.
Of course, you're in Wisconsin's biggest city. Can you talk about the role of recreation programs like this in an urban setting?
Well, for sure, a number of, again, I mentioned the 52 outdoor spaces that we manage, and I think that's so important for our city to have green spaces, places of respite they can go to and enjoy and benefit from doing outdoor recreation activities. But also just the alone with the after-school programming we do in nearly 100, over 100 locations, providing safe spaces for young people to go after the school day ends or on the weekends and really get that introduction to recreation and the benefits and the things you enjoy doing in your free time. But the fact that we service young people as, you know, infants all the way to senior adults, there's always something for everybody in our community to participate and take advantage of.
Now, you've been jumping through a lot of hoops for this national accreditation, and you've been doing a lot of it during the pandemic. How much of a wrench did that throw in this effort?
Interesting question. I mean, I think the advantage of it is that, unfortunately, a number of our programs had to be scaled back during that period while we switched to more of a virtual mode for our customer. It did give us the opportunity to focus a little more on writing the various responses to the standards we had to meet. So it did allow us to shift a little bit and spend more time, but it really came down to when the deadline was set and we knew we had, you know, the finish line ahead, getting our minds set and focusing, you know, the majority of our time on the process, I think was really going to happen either way, but definitely having a little more of that time available during the pandemic was helpful to the process.
What are your hopes for the kind of services you can provide, maybe expansions or changes or updates you can do over the next few years?
We are really focused on the improvement to our outdoor infrastructure, the play fields that we operate. We have been on since 2016. We did an assessment of all of our 52 play fields and found that over 60% were rated fair to poor. And so we have invested heavily in dollars and resources to work on a plan to revitalize those play spaces. So that is a big focus. The other focus will be for us now is maintaining our accreditation. So we're really going to be putting our energies into a number of the plans that were developed as part of the process and making sure that we're on task with all of the things, you know, we mapped out for us to follow, but also measuring our performance and making sure we're meeting customer satisfaction and delivering a quality product.
Before I let you go, Lynn, could you offer some encouragement to people to get involved with their local recreation department, whether that's Milwaukee or elsewhere in the state, as a volunteer or whatever other kind of help you need?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, first of all, I'll say as a participant, I think one of the things I really appreciate about community recreation departments is that it gives people that introduction to really a vast number of activities that they can dabble in and see if they like it, and then maybe go to a more advanced activity outside of the department that they're working with. But for us here in Milwaukee, we have hundreds of different activities for people to take advantage of. So if you're just curious about something or want to get, you know, your hands wet into something that, you know, you might enjoy, I think your local recreation department is the place to start.
Lynn, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Really appreciate it, Rob.
That was Lynn Grab, Director of Milwaukee Recreation. We talked earlier today about what her department's new national accreditation means for the community. Coming up on Central Time, we want to hear from you with your story of learning a second language, or third, fourth, or fifth language, if you've gone that far. We had a great conversation a while back about America's bilingual century. A lot of you called in. We didn't have time for all your stories, and we've been meaning to come back to it. Now is your chance. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let us know how you learned a second language, if you're learning one right now, what worked, what didn't, why you did it. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll take your calls. Maybe you can lay on some of that second language for us coming up here on Central Time. If you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network, I'm Rob Ferret. We are looking to hear from you now. Our question is, have you ever learned or tried to learn a second language? Did you grow up learning two languages? Have you learned a third or fourth or a fifth? What did it take? Are you naturally good at languages, do you think, or are you like me? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Maybe you grew up speaking English and learned another language, or maybe English is your second language. Love to hear what worked for you in learning, what some of the weirdest things you encountered along the way were. If you're learning something right now, whether you're in middle school or you're a senior, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. A little background. Talked a while back to Steve Levine. He's the author of the book America's Bilingual Century. And he had tried and not done so well with learning languages earlier in his life. Passed up, he said, a lot of great opportunities. Well, he came back to it and got him really interested in collecting the stories of all the different pathways people take to learn a second language. Well, we got a lot of great calls from you with your stories of learning languages at different ages, different places in your lives. And we ran out of time for those calls. And so we've been looking for an opportunity. Here it is to hear more of your stories. You can join in now. The number, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And I could always use some inspiration and encouragement. Didn't take any foreign languages through high school. Did a lot of German in college. Not much of it stuck with me. Tried in intensive Polish classes. It was one of the most humbling experiences in my life. Trying one of them free apps now, learning Spanish, or studying Spanish. Learning's a strong word. What's your story? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. And Anna is going to start us off in Stevens Point. Anna, hi. Thanks for calling. What's your story?
Hi. Anna Kukova. I own a business called checktalk.com. And I live here in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. I teach all online group and private Czech lessons.
It's called Czech Talk, like the Czech language.
Yeah, C-Z-E-C-H-T-A-L-K.
Okay. Now, is this for English speakers? How hard is Czech to learn? I did Polish, another Slavic, or I tried Polish, another Slavic
it's very
language.
Similar to Polish.
I had a hard time.
I grew up in the Czech Republic, about 8 kilometers from the Polish border. And it's very easy to learn to read. You can learn to read in an hour and a half to 2 hours, a phrase book or a dictionary.
And there's a lot of good reading out there in Czech. There's a lot of great Czech authors to read.
Very good Czech authors. And a lot of history books that have not been translated into English that just really shed a big light on the history of the Czech lands going way back into 600, 900.
Fantastic, Anna. And do people tend to pick it up pretty quick when they're learning it? The reading, you said, at least?
Most of my students are retired with Czech ancestry. Some are planning to be foreign exchange students going to the Czech Republic or are married to Czech spouses and want to be able to communicate with in-laws. So a lot of the students take classes for several years.
And can you leave us with a sign-off, Anna, in Czech? Keep it clean because we don't know how to check it for FCC purposes.
Drazí přátelé, jsem ráda, že jsem mohla být mezi vámi. Dear friends, I was so glad to be among you.
We're
today.
Glad you're among us. Anna, thank you so much for getting us started at 800-642-1234. Looking at your stories of learning another language. 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll go now to Elizabeth with us in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi. I grew up, my first language was a type of German dialect, more Austrian. My mother's parents were from Austria, and my father was born in Hungary and then later moved to Germany. And so I really miss speaking the language. Just lost my father to COVID last year, and he knew Hungarian, English, and German, and it was really fun to hear him speak in all three of those languages.
Do you remember, at what age did you learn English at, Elizabeth?
Well, I think I must have started learning in kindergarten. My mom knew English, but obviously both of them spoke with each other in the dialect. So maybe kindergarten. I really don't know.
I hear it's easier to learn at that younger age. Did it come easy to you?
It is. It is much easier to learn it. Between 0 and 3, actually, your language development is really that's the best time to learn. So, yeah.
Elizabeth, I'm sorry for the loss of your dad. Do you find opportunities still to speak German?
You know, once in a while, my sisters and I will speak with each other if we don't want our adult children to know what we're saying.
My grandparents used to do that to me in Polish. I love it. Elizabeth, thank you so much for sharing that. Yeah, I appreciate that story at 800-642-1234. Getting your stories of learning another language or a third or fourth language, whatever it might be, or trying and struggling with it, as some of us do. 800-642-1234 is the number. Karen joins us next in Madison. Hi, Karen.
Hi. So I remember in school we did, we have Spanish where you'd learn a few words like profesora and the colors in elementary school. And then in sixth grade, my class was the guinea pig group. They decided to see what happens if they actually try and teach foreign language to children in America. And so they set us up for German. And so we had that in sixth grade and as an option in seventh grade. They hadn't planned for eighth grade, so they ended up having to get the German teacher up before school to come teach an early bird course for those of us who wanted to continue until we could get into high school. And I've continued learning languages. I'm reasonably fluent in German and Spanish, studied other languages, some French, Portuguese, Dutch, Russian, a little bit of Italian, a little Danish.
Do you find, Karen, that learning more languages gets easier the more you have under your belt?
Yes. It is easier, but I find that there's kind of a threshold that you need to reach before it makes sense if you really want to be serious about learning another language. I think of it as like having boxes. I have my English box, and I have my Spanish box, and I have my German box. And then I have the box of all the other languages that I've been trying to learn but haven't gotten good enough yet to give their own boxes to.
Well, now there's my problem because I keep reaching to the wrong box. I was never as good at remembering German words as when I was taking a Polish class. Then all of a sudden, the German came flooding back when I didn't need it anymore. Does that ever happen to you?
Oh, yeah. I try speaking Dutch and end up speaking Portuguese and vice versa. And so any of the languages that I haven't become incredibly fluent in.
I love
that's
it.
What happens. Yeah.
Thanks so much, Karen. I do have some measure of envy for you speaking all those languages. Time for another caller. Yeah, Dory is with us in Madison. Hi, Dory.
Hi. I first started learning Norwegian when I was a child because my dad did a sabbatical in Norway. Completely forgot my Norwegian, but I learned French and Spanish later, and I'm fluent in both French and Spanish. And I have also taught Spanish to young children. And I'd like to say, first of all, if you don't have a lot of experience in language, I recommend learning an easy language first, not Polish or, I hesitate to say it, Czech, but either French, Spanish, or a Scandinavian language, which are the easiest for English speakers to learn.
Interesting. That's all the time we have, Dory. Thanks for leaving us that recommendation. Keep sharing your language stories. Email ideas@WPR.org. Tomorrow on Central Time, the U.S. has a new infrastructure spending bill in place. We'll find out what it could mean for roads, bridges, broadband, and more here in Wisconsin. That's tomorrow on Central Time.